We'd like to thank our sponsor, Purina Pro Plan, fuel for life. More sporting dog champions feed Pro Plan than any other brand of dog food.
It's great to be back with you gentlemen, and I appreciate the opportunity to have a discussion with you and share some information I hope will be interesting.
Absolutely. I'm excited.
Yeah, good. Me too. And as I begin, I want to make sure and acknowledge the good work that's been done by other historians before me. And among those are Wayne Kaputh and Mike Miller, Philip Garone, and Frank Hall. They've all done a great job. So today, we're going to be talking about the Delta and the Yolo Basin. And more than a century ago, historian George Tinkham described the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta as an inland sea of tules and water. Its riverbanks, carpeted with wildflowers, blackberries, roses, native grasses, and fillery. Its rivers and sloughs shrouded by oak and cottonwood trees and willows filled with blackbirds. And author John Muir, of course known as the father of national parks, called the Delta and the surrounding lands the floweriest place on earth. Since the coming of time, American natives, primarily the Yokuts and the Wintons, prized the Delta and its bounty for hunting elk and black-tailed deer, pronghorn antelope, and fishing for massive numbers of Chinook salmon and steelhead. Setting back succession was an annual ritual. Native Americans would clear the bogs and high ground by burning the tules, described by one writer as the most magnificent spectacle ever witnessed. Each autumn, the entire Delta was a vast conflagration of flames. New growth followed with the passing of each season. It was the native people's way of managing the landscape. The Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta encompasses more than 500,000 acres of profoundly fertile silt and peat soils. It borders Sherman Island to the west, the Yolo Basin to the north, Stockton to the east, and the San Joaquin Valley to the south. One-third of California's fresh water drains into it and through the Delta, 40% of which is our drinking water and 45% of the irrigation water. Mostly reclaimed islands that lie below sea level, the Delta has been called the Netherlands of California. Grain, corn, tomatoes, and asparagus are harvested annually. Still, with all the tillage, the Delta provides home for millions of wintering waterfowl. But the number of wintering waterfowl year after year are falling drastically. California is in the sobering process of finding that the birds can be ruined and lost entirely. It's about meeting the frequently contrary expectations and desires against the evolving needs of complex natural processes. It's about seeking harmony between our primal home, the needs of wild places and wild creatures, and humans. In 1850, when the California Gold Rush was at its peak, the federal government transferred swamp and overflowed lands, including the Delta, to California. In 1855, the state government enacted legislation to allow the sale of those lands to individuals so that the swamps could be drained. By 1868, the islands in the Delta were, for the most part, privately owned, and drainage efforts were underway. The wooded banks of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Rivers were diked and converted to orchards and fields to row crops and grains. Levees were built by the Asians, who used shovels and wheelbarrows. Sherman Island, at the west edge of the Delta, was the first to be enclosed. But with peat soil, often up to 60 feet deep, they were too weak. Eventually, floating dredges with long booms and clamshell buckets were used to build levees that could withstand all but the most severe flooding. Today's major concern is twofold, both the ever-increasing saltwater intrusion now, which is all the way up to Rio Vista, and the ever-increasing draw of Sacramento-San Joaquin River water for their respective valleys' irrigated agriculture, and of course, Southern California urban development. Early explorers and travelers frequently referred to the huge concentrations of waterfowl they observed. In his journal of his 1846 and 47 California exploration, entitled What I Saw in California, Edwin Bryant recounted, "Large numbers of ducks were flying about everywhere. Tens of thousands of wild geese and other waterfowls are on the islands and on the waters, making a prodigious crackling. The myriads of ducks and geese and other waterfowls swarmed, and I luxuriated on wild ducks all the time I was there." Another often quoted early traveler, Lansford Hastings, in his Immigrant's Guide to Oregon and California, wrote in 1845, "Various feathered tribes, or waterfowl, are said to congregate upon the waters in such immense numbers that one person may, with very little difficulty, kill several hundred in a few hours." Now, it's important to remember that black powder was still the propellant in use at this time. And while crossing the delta at night, he could not sleep because of the constant and deafening roar of waterfowl. He stated, "I've been greatly annoyed by the almost deafening, tumultuous, and confused noise of innumerable flocks, ducks, and geese." As in all major wetlands, market hunters preceded sport hunters in the Delta beginning in the 1870s. Because of innumerable sloughs and tules, they relied on arks and scows for housing, and they moved frequently. Sport hunters and club hunters were soon to follow in the 1880s. The earliest club was on Twitchell Island. It started in 1880 and likewise used first of all an ark as its clubhouse. Now, at the turn of the 20th century, the Delta was greatly transformed from crops virtually every island. As in the west side of Sassoon Marsh, clubs had arranged with railroads to stop at clubs as a convenience to owners and guests. So too in the Delta, commercial boats, when signaled, would stop at clubs. With time, clubs acquired their own launches. Interestingly, Venice Island still today uses its private ferry, having been in use since the 1970s. The Delta has been celebrated historically for its fabulous mallard hunting, and today, of course, the unbelievable speck hunt. The threat of island flooding is still very real in the Delta, the most recent being Jones Tract, including its clubhouse that floated away in 2004. Some islands, including Venice, Lower Roberts, and Quimby, which of course is now owned by CWA, have flooded four times. Almost island has flooded at least once. One club, Ringe Tract, has four clubs on it. Mandeville Island, one of the largest at 5,200 acres, has perhaps the most impressive clubhouse complex, followed closely by Venice Island, and had perhaps the largest development for waterfowl in the Delta, now much converted back to agriculture, and it's known as the unofficial Delta Refuge. It's acknowledged for its attraction to waterfowl in little use. Legendary waterfowl hunter Dan Nomellini, affectionately known as Delta King, successfully developed and sold several island duck clubs, including the Delta Gun Club on Lower Jones Tract in 1947. By the way, it's the oldest active duck club of continuous service in the region. Now, he called the Delta a paradise for wildlife. In 1958, he founded Venice Island Duck Club and brought from Hollywood the rich and the famous Baron Hilton, Clark Gable, Edward Pauly, and D.K. Ludwig, who was believed to be the wealthiest person in the U.S. at the time. Now, Hilton was especially enamored with the Delta. He was known to ask wealthy guests, "Do you know what is the most valuable place of property in California?" "Called the Mallard Hole, and it's on Venice Island." Now, you know, I've been to Venice Island several times.
Yeah.
And one of the newest thing there is the memorabilia that's been left there, not just by Barron, but by Clark Gable, including under a glass lid that you can see through is his last glass of scotch.
Oh,
prolific,
that's super cool.
Scotch drinker. He would come up almost every weekend after work in Hollywood and fly up with Barron and spend the weekend there and back.
And when did that club start? You said the
Well, Baron started in the late 60s.
Okay.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I had the wonderful privilege of flying down one time and visiting with Baron for a whole day in his office.
Oh, wow.
And you have never met a more perfect gentleman. He was absolutely wonderful. And, you know, each time I would go and visit with somebody and interview him, I'd always write him a letter, you know, a thank you letter. Unbelievably, Baron Hilton wrote me a thank you letter.
Oh, wow.
And just spoke about how much he appreciated being able to, you know, think about the old times. So on and so on. Absolutely.
Wow.
Now, Dan Nomellini often warned potential island buyers about the risk of owning tracts on the fragile diked peat lands. You'll never really own these islands. You'll buy them, they'll flood, and then you'll buy them back again. Across the deep water ship channel from Venice Island is Medford Island, one of the best managed and best shooting islands in the Delta. Interestingly, it is the only island in the Delta that is not cropped for income producing revenue. There are several islands with farms, including Bolden, Venice, Mandeville, McDonald, Ringe Tract, Upper Jones Tract, and others. Wetlands restoration is taking place, among others, on Medford, Bacon, Bolden, and Sherman Islands, as well as Holland, Palm, and Webb Tracts. Some public hunting is still available via boat through the Delta. You know, you can pull up almost anywhere against an island, as well as the Big Break, Clifton Court, state leased spots for floating blinds in Frank's Tract, Stone Lakes National Wildlife Refuge, Decker Island, Sherman Island, Rhode Island, and White Slough Wildlife Areas. Now, contiguous to Delta in the north is the Yolo Basin, and it's formed by the floodwaters of the Sacramento and Feather Rivers. Below where they join, these waters split and go southeast into the American Basin, also known as the Natomas Basin, just northwest of Sacramento, and they also go southwest into the Yolo Basin, immediately north of the Delta. And personally, I consider, you know, the Yolo Basin to be an extension of the Delta.
They kind of blend into each other.
Absolutely. They look very similar in some respects. And, you know, as you mentioned, they flow together. Now, the first clubs there were in the 1880s through the 90s. 100 years ago, there was a great hunting in all of the directions from Sacramento. The American Basin was reclaimed by the Natomas Company by about 1900 for agriculture. Because of the proximity of both the American and Yolo Basins, most hunters in Sacramento areas hunted both of these basins. The first club in the American Basin was begun in 1883. It was the Canvasback Club. Major hunting areas were the Fishermen's and the Brush Lakes, north of Sacramento. Now, when this area was reclaimed, many of the area's hunters moved into the Butte Sink. The Yolo Basin was reclaimed later, and the first club, the Glide Tule Ranch, began in 1895. It encompassed some 11,000 acres in the Puta Creek Sink. It was 8 miles from Sacramento, and at times, it's been said that it could be reached in 40 minutes by buggy, which is the way most people went in those days. Eventually, it was broken into 7 clubs in the 1950s and the 80s. The Glide, the Conaway, H. Pond, Senator, which was built by Chris Folster. I think most of us know Chris for the great duck cleaning business that
he
had.
So that entire area was owned by the Glide family?
Yeah, initially, yes.
Yeah. Up until the 50s, and then it split.
And then it split into several smaller
clubs. Which is crazy. Can you imagine if they had that one club today still, 70 years later, and it was...
Well, just the Conaway now is huge.
That's crazy.
Anyways, a few other clubs that it broke into were the Skyrakers and the Firemen's. And it's called the Firemen's because it's hunted by firemen.
Yeah.
You know? There's another one that, you know, I haven't read about, but it was pointed out to me. And I went and, you know, I've been to all these, take a look at them and nicely spend time with people and learn from them. But one was called the Treehouse. And I was able to find this location. And the remains of a huge treehouse is up in this massive oak tree.
Hmm.
And that was their clubhouse.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, then eventually became the portion of the Yolo State Wildlife Refuge. The bypass between Davis and Sacramento was finished in 1916. The Fremont Weir Wildlife Area has some public hunting. And today, state flowage easements exist, and nothing is allowed that may impede floodwater.
But in terms of the delta early on, you know, they're digging their man-made dikes. What are the initial crops? Is it people with dairies like in the Sassoon Marsh? Is it corn? Is it vines? What were some of those earlier crops?
They were the grains. They were corns and wheat from the very start.
Okay.
And of course, more recently, tomatoes and asparagus. And I'll tell you, if you've ever eaten an asparagus from one of the islands in the Delta,
yeah.
you know you've gone to heaven.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And the interesting thing about asparagus, of course, is they're a root, mm-hmm. and when they sprout up, they get to a certain stage of development, and they cut them off, goes back again.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
They might get three crops.
Yeah.
In a good warm season.
Absolutely.
I just think the Delta is so strange in a way because, you know, when we go set our blinds out at Quimby, you drive past Frank's Tract, and it's just open as open can get, and these giant blinds that stick out. And we know a few people that have hunted out there, and they're like, yeah, we kill ducks.
They
like,
shoot really well.
Like, this makes no sense in everything that I've been told. Like, you can't kill ducks in this giant open body of water with this giant blind, but... I mean, there's places to go otherwise, public waterway, like you said, you can legally get next to a levee. You can't step out of your boat onto a levee, but as long as you can kill your birds into the water, it's legal, and sloughs and that sort of thing. But a lot of the Delta is private clubs on islands other than the main waterways, basically.
Well, Frank's tract, and I have been privileged to hunt there a few times, has a number of floating blinds out there, and they're all permitted by the state. And, mm-hmm. if you go somewhere and there's a stilt blind that's not occupied, the culture is that you can go in there as long as the owner's not there and you respect it. You leave it as you found it. If the owner shows up, wants to invite you to hunt with him, great. If not, the proper thing is to do is go ahead and pack up and allow them to hunt their stilt blind.
Now, do you see changes in the Delta now with like people putting in more, vineyards and things like that that wasn't historically a crop?
Well, one of the most recognized areas that, people are aware of starts on the west side, the east side of the Delta, out off of 8 Mile Road. And there are several clubs on the way out there, and the road is 8 miles long. That's the name. But for about the first 4 miles now, it's amazing how quickly it's being developed for homes.
Oh, homes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There was a period in time where they had a lot of interesting blueberry farming going on out there and some orchards and things of that nature. But even those are being taken out now to extend the housing. It's going to be at least halfway out there very, very soon.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's going to change.
Right.
There's no question about it.
Yeah. Well, like listening to stories of like the Sassoon Marsh, some of the old club members, they wouldn't go hunting until, 9 or 10 when the sprig were coming back from, the cornfields or whatever from eating all night. I think it's a really cool area. Seems to be a lot more mallards there that you could frequently harvest. And for such a large area, the pressure is not as high as, if you go up in the rice country in Colusa, there's a blind every rice check, right?
Yeah.
So down there, there's some private islands and things like that or Frank's Tract, but even when you're out there, you don't hear like the high gunning as in some other areas. So you could have a quality hunt, even if you don't see as many birds, because the birds seem to work a little better because you're not as much pressure. It doesn't seem like it, but.
But it's changing on the islands as well.
Oh, I bet.
It's been a monoculture for a long time. It was corn, corn, corn.
Mm-hmm.
And now we see some of the islands changing their crops, a lot more tomatoes, even some rice going back in.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is true.
And then, of course, you look at the clubs that are either all or almost all natural habitat. The key to me, you know, my way of thinking is to have sequential feeding. And if that includes some corn and other crops, just as fine, you know, just as well. But I think the most important thing is to have sequential feeding. As one crop goes out, one natural seed bed goes out, you go to the next and the next and the next. What we have seen over the last couple of years, though, is not as many mallards. There seems to be more geese now. Not just the specks, but a lot of snows.
Yeah.
A lot of Aleutians.
Lots of
Aleutians. You know, of course, that's an amazing thing that's happened, the resurgence of the Aleutians in California.
Yeah.
So a lot of goose hunting is taking place in the Delta. Still some great duck hunting, no question about it. But you will see more geese than in the.
Yeah, I would second that. I think, it could be world-class goose hunting right there with all the different species and opportunities there. I mean, on one hunt, you could shoot specks, snows, you know, Aleutians. There's some graders out there. And with the number of geese that we could shoot now, it makes for a pretty phenomenal opportunity.
Yeah.
But no, the Delta's special. I always like it if we get an opportunity to hunt down there, especially for geese. I think Aleutians decoy really, really well when they do it, and they're just fun to go after.
Well, yeah. You know, it is a unique place, and as Dorothy said in The Wizard of Oz, in Kansas.
Yeah.
So, you know you're somewhere special when you're in the Delta.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's most morning, you can't look in a direction and not see
a grind of geese.
Yeah, or hear them, right? I mean, it's just phenomenal. It's
on crazy. Somebody's island.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, it's interesting. We've had a hunt out there before, and the geese just bills were black with that soil from eating their comeback to get water, and it was like every goose you killed was just black bill. And it's like, wow, that's kind of cool to see, like, you know, they're coming back and getting water and you're part of the process. Usually you just shoot them and you know you don't know if they're coming in there to loaf or to eat or to do whatever. You could tell their comeback because they were thirsty.
You know, talking about Pete, you know, we've all hunted areas that are real muddy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's tough walking through it and so on. But, you know, when you walk in Pete,
mm-hmm.
you better be, you know, physically able. It's very different. And when you get in, if you don't wash yourself off,
oh god,
you know, it's a mess.
Yeah, that and your dog just stink in your hands.
It'll stain your skin.
Yeah, but like walking in a cornfield in the Delta, it could be rough. I mean,
oh god,
and there's also a little something called the potato ditches,
spud.
Spud ditches.
Found a few.
I'll tell you what, you don't ever want to walk through. A corn patch or a potato patch, you know, without knowing where those ditches are, because you are gonna go swimming.
Yeah, we've a walking stick.
We've had a great relationship with Staten Island out there, and theirs is converted to rice now. But when we had the corn out there, we went out there and marked all the spud ditches so people could see it,
because
we knew the dangers of that happening.
Yeah, yeah, and we did give folks some walking poles and things like that,
but.
Yeah, gosh, that is some rough.
That's rough a go. It's much better now that it's rice.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's something that, you know, very special about being in the Delta. And, you know, if you get an opportunity to go to one of the islands to hunt, and you can through CWA, of course,
mm-hmm.
Take advantage of it. You'll come back knowing that you've built memory.
Yeah, and like we were talking about, the Delta kind of then runs north into the Yolo Bypass area, Yolo Basin. Why do you think those clubs aren't on the people's forefronts when it comes to, like, oh, the best clubs in California, oh, this and that? You know, you think the Sink, and then a lot of people will go straight to Suisun and almost like jump over the section that is the Yolo Basin.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't think you're going to see that reoccurring as frequently now, because I think, you know, people are learning that the hunting could be pretty darn good there.
Mm-hmm.
And for a variety of reasons. I think the wildlife area there has done a lot to enhance what's going on, the other types of
Absolutely.
Development that are going on. The challenge that there might be in the future is what they're doing in regards to possible flooding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the knock.
And there's conversation about that keeping certain areas flooded all the time or most of the time. And that's going to change the thing.
Right. Absolutely. You know?
But beautiful land out there, great clubs. They take great pride in what they're doing. And I would encourage everybody to take a look at it if you get the opportunity. Great, great refuge to hunt on.
Yeah, I grew up hunting that refuge when I was living in Roseville. I'd be out there every Saturday, Sunday, Wednesday. And one of the things I don't think people realize about that refuge is it's so big. I mean, it's basically from the top of the bypass for miles south.
Yeah.
It's giant. So lots of opportunity to go out there and explore.
Well, it's in regards to that, then it's saved forever. Mm-hmm. It's that portion of it.
Right.
And I concur with you. Take advantage of it. It's a great place to hunt.
And Yancey, what was the time frame between the first club in Sassoon starting and the Delta?
About approximately the same time.
Yeah.
You know, or clubs. Of course, they started hunting Sassoon Marsh a bit before the Delta.
Okay.
Before, you know, the market hunters started going into the Delta. But approximately the same time.
Okay.
You know, late 70s, early 80s, when you had your first clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, market hunters, as I mentioned, and then subsistence hunters hunted it long before that.
This is just a guess. I'm guessing those folks were coming from Sacramento instead of coming from San Francisco as far as like market hunters and that stuff. Were they still coming from San Francisco all the way over to the Yolo Basin?
Most of them came from the San Francisco area.
Okay.
So they'd go out there in their arcs and scout and set up.
Gosh, it says taking waterways all the way up there.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, of course, some came from Sacramento, but San Francisco had a real tradition of market hunters working out of there because that's where most of their product went.
Okay, that's where the market was.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when trains became available, a lot went to, believe it or not, the L.A. Basin. Because to the LA Basin because there wasn't a real history of market hunting down there. I mean, ducks were very prolific. Yeah, waterfowl were, and I know we'll talk about that eventually, but they just didn't have the history of market hunting down there at Northern California.
Interesting.
It's like having the plethora of crops or whatever available for you and nobody knows how to get them out of the ground. Like it was all there, just nobody knew how to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Well, we'll jump into where are we going next.
Well, I'd love to talk to you a little bit about the Tulare Basin and Kern and Buena Vista basins just below them. Fabulous area, amazing history. You know, most people are not aware that the San Joaquin Valley really is divided into two halves, not physically, but geographically. The north half, of course, is where the grasslands are, all of the Miller and Lux lands, and then the south half of it is referred to as the Tulare Basin. So let's take a look at that. Earlier, you know, we had discussed the Sacramento Valley basins as well as the grasslands in the northern half of the San Joaquin Valley. Today, I'd like to discuss the southern half of the San Joaquin Valley, the Tulare Basin, and also the Kern, Buena Vista, and Goose Lake basins. And Goose Lake, of course, is another one of those wonderful places that CWA owns and provides hunting opportunities. Now, California's Great Central Valley is over 430 miles long and averages about 50 miles wide, some 15 million acres in total, one of the world's largest valleys. And it's California's core, and it drains two major river systems, the Sacramento River flowing south through the Sacramento Valley, which includes Colusa, Butte, Sutter, Yuba, and American basins, and the San Joaquin River flowing north through the San Joaquin Valley, with the north half including the grasslands and the south half including Tulare, Kern, Buena Vista, and Goose Lake basins. Now, the two rivers coalesced just south of the Yolo Basin in the Delta, where they then pour into the San Francisco Bay. These three connected areas, the Sacramento Valley, the Delta, the San Joaquin Valley, constitute the realm's major subregion. 200 years ago, the narrow Sacramento Valley to the far north was characterized by vast riparian forest and large marshes, both products of the seasonal surges of the mighty stream and its tributaries. Since Shasta Dam has reduced and tamed the Sacramento River's volume, and most of its tributaries have been dammed, those overflows have been mitigated, but its channels still bisect the verdant prairies following a course near its center. The drainages of the Sacramento and San Joaquin Rivers converge in the Delta, which before development channeled an average of 8.8 trillion gallons of water annually and was filled with riverine forest along the many purling channels of streams born in high mountains. Marshes and sloughs and swamps also characterize this region. Now, it's been thoroughly diked, somewhat drained, and religiously cultivated, although never completely controlled. In the lower San Joaquin section, which widens to 75 miles at one point, the land slopes distinctly from the east, and the river cuts across its dry surface, then winds along the once barren western side. Here, in the old days, parched prairies dominated, and William Henry Brewer described it in 1863 as a plain of absolute desolation. Dams and irrigation projects have considerably enriched the land through which the San Joaquin River travels, just as they have altered and diminished the stream itself and its attendant wetlands. South of the grasslands area of the San Joaquin Valley lies the lower section of the valley, known as the Tulare Basin, and where any drainage north was blocked by the Kings River alluvial fan, lay the wetlands of the entire basin, including Tulare Lake, and the Kern, Buena Vista, and Goose Lakes. Here, vast tracts of rushes led the Spaniards to name it El Valle de los Tulares, the Valley of the Tules, and wetlands there were bordered paradoxically by arid and semi-arid tracts, even alkali desert in places. It was a strange region of contrast, broad, shallow lakes shimmering in a desert. Since the region itself originally was rich in rivers, marshes, and swamps, all the result of drainage from the nation's deepest snowpack in the Sierra Nevada, which borders it to the east, even the South Valley's relatively low and distinctly seasonal rainfall was not a major hardship. On the vast plains grazed various ruminants, herbivorous grazers like the elk, antelope, and others. While its wastewaters and lakes provided not only native vegetation and animals, but also trout and salmon, and innumerable ducks and geese, of course. But today, private and coordinated reclamation efforts have significantly reduced the extent of the Great Central Valley wetlands. In the San Joaquin Valley, the conversion of wetlands for agriculture by small farmers and land barons alike proceeded in both the upper San Joaquin and lower Tulare basins. But nowhere were the ecological effects of this conversion of the landscape as profound and as visually apparent as in the Tulare Basin. With rivers dammed, marshes and lakes drained, the Tulare Basin now boasts miles of orchards and cultivated fields. Oil pumps dot the desecrated hills on its southeastern and southwestern edges. In its time, the Tulare Basin was one of the most important wintering areas of the Pacific Flyway waterfowl in California. Tulare Lake, at that time, was one of the largest bodies of surface area freshwater in the United States, west the Great Lakes. Tulare Lake and its environs is a sub-basin of the larger Tulare Basin. Before diversions, it was fed by the Kings, Kaweah, and Tule Rivers. The Kern River fed the Kern 8,000-acre Kern Lake and the 4,000-acre Buena Vista Lake, situated at an extreme southern end of the basin. Buena Vista Lake then drained northward into the 60-mile-long Buena Vista Slough, then through the Goose Lake, as I mentioned today, owned by CWA, and then ultimately into Tulare Lake. The lake's highest level ever was during the spring flood of 1862 due to heavy rains, when the lake reached a depth of 37 feet, when normally it's about 10 to 15 feet. And it covered 760 square miles, more than twice the size of Lake Tahoe. At its highest levels, the lake flows back into the San Joaquin River. Of the 625,000 acres of original wetlands in the basin, virtually none remain today. A portion of the lake has reappeared on various occasions of particularly large spring runoff, most recently in 1969, 1983, and again in 2023. Interestingly, each time this happens, a large number of sprig, up to some 40,000, remain to nest in the area. And to me, that indicates that in times past, many more birds stayed in California to nest than could be possibly imagined. The sad part of the floodwaters that are drained quickly, leaving the birds to suffer the effects of heat-induced botulism. Also interesting is the fact that prior to the completion of drainage in 1895, steamboats once plied its waters, and there were so many fish and turtles in the lake that commercial fisheries were established, with their catches sent by train to San Francisco.
Our hunt program is now accepting applications for fall hunts. Fall hunts include deer, turkey, dove, goose, and duck. CWA now has a new hunt opportunity at Potrero Hills Duck Club, which borders Denverton. Visit calwaterfowl.org to apply today. While you're there, don't miss our membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free 80th anniversary hat while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for waterfowl conservation. Upcoming events are Palo Alto Banquet, September 4th, Modesto Banquet, September 6th, Blackhawk Banquet, September 11th, and Marin County Banquet, September 11th.
By the early 1870s, most of the Tulare Basin had been passed into private hands, and irrigation had become a significant feature of the region. By 1881, settlers began filing claims along the margins of the retreating lake, and the marshlands were replaced by irrigated fields. The Kern, Buena Vista, and Goose Lakes basins suffered equally from the effects of reclamation during the same time. It was about this area that the most important and far-reaching legislation regarding water rights in California was adjudicated. As succinctly as possible, Miller and Lux had brought suit against Hagen to control water in these lake basins. Now, Hagen is known very well to the folks, especially in the Stockton area, because there's a major museum named after him there. Oh. But Miller and Lux brought suit against Hagen to control water in these lake basins. Miller and Lux advocated for riparian rights, which mean if you border a stream, it guarantees full natural flow of that water, which had its origins in English common law. And Hagen advocated for prior appropriation rights, which meant for the best and most appropriate use. This lawsuit established the dual doctrines of riparian and appropriate water rights, known subsequently as the California Doctrine. The reclamation of the Tulare Basin waters and destruction of wetlands throughout the basin destroyed a rich and complex ecosystem upon which myriad organisms depended. Among the different species, waterfowl were certainly the most dramatically affected. Waterfowl hunting in the Tulare Basin lakes has been phenomenal during the decades preceding the lake's reclamation and subsequent disappearance. Waterfowl at this time were described as innumerable, and for many years, market hunters shipped large numbers of ducks and geese to markets in San Francisco and Stockton. Club hunting in the basin started in the early 1890s near Bakersfield, but noteworthy was the establishment of the Widgeon Gun Club in 1895, which is still active today. That's 130 years. Now, there's somebody we all know who was a member there at one time, and that's Craig Griglione. I'm sure you know Craig.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Craig's an amazing supporter of CWA and a phenomenal hunter. And anyways, it's located near Hanford, originally on the southeastern shore of the then full Tulare Lake. Now, there's a very interesting story about the Wijing Gun Club that I'd like to share with you. And at one point, early on, one of the members had a special 20-gauge Parker side-by-side built. And the other club members saw this and absolutely fell in love with it. So they ordered 9 more. So there's this famous set of 10 20-gauge Parkers that came to the Wijing Club. The interesting thing about them is none of them had a safety. They were, you know, they were, when you closed the barrels on the stock, it was ready to go.
Oh, gosh.
Now, you know, people have been looking for those guns for some time, and I'm sure many of them have been found by none, but I got to see and hold one once.
Oh, nice.
And it was down in the San Jacinto Valley. There was a gentleman down there named Dr. Harold Hill, who developed, by the way, most of the clubs in the San Jacinto Valley. And Harold owned one of those guns. And I was invited to his house, and he opened up his gun safe and showed me this. And you can imagine a big smile appeared on my face because the privilege to see and hold one of those was very special. Now, shortly after the start of the 20th century, clubs started developing more frequently. Perhaps the best known was the El Cinco in 1905, and still active today. And I've been there, a neat old place. And as I mentioned, it's significant that it's still
active. How big are some of these clubs that are still there?
They're probably less than 200 acres.
Okay,
you know, most of them in that realm, anywhere from 70 to 200 acres.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Now, over time, there were at least 200 clubs in the Tulare Basin. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Can you imagine the waterfowl hunting to support that?
Yeah.
And there were 96 in the Kern, Buena Vista, and Goose Lake basins. Oh. And I'd been to Goose Lake, the ranch that controlled that,
mm-hmm.
Probably 30 years ago when it was still, you know, active in agriculture and so on. And what a wonderful history. It was just a real privilege to be able to spend some time there. Just the number of club gives an indication of how prevalent duck clubs were and how good duck and goose hunting was. There were even a few commercial day shooting clubs for the unattached hunters, the most well-known and successful being the Gilbreth Brothers, which was located off of Gun Club Road near Wasco and the south end of the Kern Refuge. They had 14 clubs with 32 ponds, a total of 800 fluttered acres for some 300 shooters at one point.
Oh, wow.
Still active as late as 1983. It's important to note that phenomenal as the hunting was up through the 50s and still fairly good through the 70s and even a bit into the 80s, agricultural water practices had reached a point where the number of clubs in the entire Tulare Basin could be counted on one hand and maybe a few toes. But fortunately, there's been a resurgence of duck clubs in the last decade or a bit longer, and there are now some 30-plus clubs in the basin, most located near the Kern National Wildlife Refuge, which is west of Wasco. And there are a few public shooting areas as well. And I'm proud to say one special one owned and operated by CWA at Goose Lake, a bit southwest of the Kern Refuge near the town of Buttonwillow on Highway 5. Now, most of the information of Tulare Basin duck clubs can be found in a great book published in 1990 by Donald Hull entitled Vanishing Wings. And I'm going to encourage anybody to get that who might have an interest in the Tulare Basin. So I'm going to draw on it almost entirely for this selection. plus comments by the beloved protector of the basin and Waterfowl Hall of Fame inductee, Ray Lamucci. The best overall hunting in the area basins took place during the 20s to the 40s. Without question, the most intriguing aspect was the well-known and highlighted connection there between Hollywood movie stars and the individual clubs in the Tulare Basin, both in the Wasco and Kern Buena Vista Lakes areas. Now, it's interesting to note that most male stars, and at least one female star as well, were prolific trap shooters and duck hunters during this area. Taking advantage of the relatively close proximity of Hollywood, celebrities would frequently leave the movie sets on Friday to arrive at their clubs or hotel in time for dinner and festivities. After dinner, there were often all-night parties, which continued until the morning hunts. After their hunts were over, there was time for a quick bite, pick up their duck limits, often all sprig, and head back to Hollywood for their afternoon movie shoot. And it wasn't just the stars, because also regularly hunting were the studio owners, the directors, the producers, and well-reputed mobsters. The real story is what took place the night before their hunts. Party. And I mean party hardy and all that that refers. Now, because the celebrities hunted in so many different clubs, sometimes as many and other times as guest, and often hunting at several different clubs in each season, I'm going to mention celebrities' names and the most sought-after clubs they hunted the most. Biggest name Hollywood celebrities hunting regularly in the Kern and Buena Vista basins were often at the Fleischman's Club, like in Margarine. And anyways, they were Clark Gable, Carol Lombard, who became his wife, Tom Mix, Charleston Heston, and Spencer Tracy. And at the MGM Club, Dick Powell, Glenn Ford, Wallace Berry, Douglas Fairbanks, Lionel Barrymore, Robert Taylor, Frank Capra, Frank Morgan. And at the Ten Strike Club, Fred McMurray, Joel McRae, Gary Cooper, Randolph Scott, Errol Flynn. Another important and respected club was the Los Angeles Athletic Club, where Daryl Zenuck belonged. And by the way, it was an actual club in the L.A. Basin, and the hunting grounds were part of that. If you were a member of the club,
That was my question. I was like, the Athletic Club. I know some weird names for duck clubs.
Very famous. And, you know, the demise was caused by the fact that Highway 5 at one point ran right through it.
Oh, really? Huh. Wow.
Yeah. Now, those who brought dates, and I guess that's what you'd call them, often stayed at the Lebec Hotel, located a short way up the Grapevine. And in the Wasco areas, which originally grew rice, by the way, when first developed in 1905, even before when it was grown in the North Sacramento Valley, hunting there were such notables as John Wayne, Ward Bond, Henry Fonda, and Robert Stack, who's acknowledged as the best shot in the basin. At the John Wayne Club, also known as the Cherokee or Boxcar Club, also in that area, just off of Gun Club Road, was the Cinco Five that we mentioned earlier, which was built in 1905, the oldest in the area, and still, by the way, active today. Hollywood, Beverly, Universal, 20th Century, the Donald Duck, the Miramonte, the Palooza, and the Sierra Club Gun Clubs were there. Those who brought dates, and there's that description again, stayed at the Bakersfield Inn. So many people from the Los Angeles area hunted in the Tulare Basin that the Gilbreth brothers maintained an office, actually, and a phone number in the Los Angeles to help with the booking hunts for their day shoot clubs in the 1950s. How good was the shooting? Well, the Merritt Ranch Duck Club had 25 limits for 25 shooters. That's 625 ducks on opening day in 1923. And the Los Angeles Gun Club had a record of every shooter taking their limit of 25 ducks on opening day in 1924. Not too shabby, huh?
Yeah.
It was quite a phenomenal hunting area. The 1970s through the 1980s was a time when the vast majority of the clubs in the Tulare Basin shut down and sold out. The reasons and conditions were fairly common for all the clubs that closed their doors. You know, there were dams on major rivers, loss of groundwater, increased pumping cost, subsidized agribusiness, failing water quality, expansion of land farmed due to water deliveries from the California Water Project, pervasive pesticide problems, pervasive salt buildup, skyrocketing land values, and the longer growing seasons of the farms. The recent rejuvenation and development of new clubs during the past 15 years in the Kern Refuge area have been accredited to several sources: the Tulare Basin Wetland Association, CWA, EU, NRCS, Nature Conservancy, the California Fish and Wildlife Department, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Wetland restoration has been spurred by conservation easements. Nevertheless, at times, some clubs are unable to flood up.
That's one of the places, I think, you talk about places you wish you could walk and see. Because in some of the other areas, say Sassoon or the Sink, you can imagine what it's like because most of it's still there. But you go drive, even when you're by our property at Goose Lake, like you drive through orchards to get there, and then all of a sudden there's water. Like, I had no clue they grew rice down there. Can you imagine that?
First I ever heard that. Yeah, well...
Well, the whole San Joaquin Valley grew rice at one time, even the northern half of it.
Can you imagine the duck shooting on that with harvesting practices, lots of waste grain? But, I mean, here's the largest freshwater lake west of the Mississippi that, as of 2 years ago, it hadn't existed in, 60-plus years or whatever it was. But that's what's astonishing to me is you drive down there and it's literally... Other than farms, it's desert. Like a desert, you know.
And you know what? Those are not family farms.
No,
they're big.
You know, the Boswell family owned something like 400,000 acres of agriculture down there.
Oh, wow.
Chevron has huge properties. The LA Times owns huge properties down there. It's kind of interesting how they acquired all of that. Tulare Lake flooded frequently, and it was tough to start agriculture. You never knew when you were going to be flooded out. So a proposal went, again, by some of the large agribusiness people. Proposal went to the federal government to build a dam, Kings River, Bryant Dam. And it was under the auspices of flood control, but in reality, it was for irrigation storage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when this was approved, you weren't supposed to be able to acquire the rights to irrigation water if you owned over 160 acres.
You weren't?
No.
Really?
It had to be 160 acres or less to be able to irrigate from that that supply. Well, you know for a fact that some of these large industrial agricultural situations would have hundreds of 160-acre parcel, quote-unquote, donated to them. So it was an interesting process how they grew.
Oh, wow.
By the way, when Fryant Dam went in, that's what destroyed the San Joaquin Valley, because for at least 50 miles below it, it's empty.
Yeah.
There is no water. It's circumvented. You know, it's channelized around there. Now, San Joaquin Valley, you know, we always talk about the salmon fishing in times past in the Sacramento River. It was nothing compared to San Joaquin. The San Joaquin had such phenomenal salmon fishing that they actually had three canneries right on the river.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I know there's a huge effort to try to restore salmon fishery in the San Joaquin. It'll be interesting to see how that progresses.
When did that dam, when was it finalized and built?
I think it was 47, if I remember correctly.
So they had about 10 to 20 years after that, which was still okay hunting, and then essentially just...
Let me tell you, there are places I know of in the Tulare Basin now purposely dike up, flood in the winter so they can hunt.
Yeah, we had we had our best year ever at Goose Lake this year. We had water early. We had really good growth. I think one of my favorite things is, you know, I'll get a call from one of our customers and, hey, I got drawn down at Goose Lake. How many goose decoys should I bring? I'm like, dude, we haven't shot geese down there in years. And then this year, they actually killed like two cacklers and a couple specks or something like that. And I was like, oh my gosh, they're coming back.
Well, what was interesting is during the drought, there's over the hill west of Wasco and stuff, there's a particular lake up there, and a gentleman called me and was like, hey, you know, they have a cabin up there. He's like, hey, I saw some specks. Our family's been up here for 20 plus years, never seen these specks. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And we went down there like a week later, and you know, there's no water on the landscape, but there's a big solar farm kind of next to our property, and there's specks out in the sage and stuff randomly. And one of our employees is like, we saw some specks out here. I was like, there's no way. And then literally someone confirmed it in the same area. I was like, it's baffling.
Well, you know, I live in Santa Rosa, you know, up in the wine country, about an hour north of San Francisco. And there's an interesting lagoon area about 15 minutes from my house between Santa Rosa and Sebastopol. And you know, I'll talk to you a little bit later about it. But I've been hunting out there for 60 years, and it can be quite good still, you know, especially duck hunting and large Canadian hunting. But there have been times in big storms when I've seen specks out there.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, they'll get off course.
Yep.
And come up that valley. So they're prone to roam a bit.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. Do you remember during the drought there was a speck that went on the Giants field?
Yeah.
In the middle of the game. Yeah, during a game, and there no one knew what it was, you know, they're but it was, yeah, it was a speck, and it was on the field.
You sure it wasn't a large seagull?
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty funny. But yeah, I mean, a lot of weird stuff happens during droughts, but I think that area in particular down there, what it was like, I mean, some of the early pioneers, you know, talking about the blankets of feathers that are along the shoreline, and to drive around now not to see any water is pretty sad.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the blanket of feathers around. That's one of the chief ways of scouting, of course, if you can find a slough, a pond, whatever, you know, that's covered in feathers.
Yeah.
And the wind will make it blow up to one particular side of the area, of course.
Right.
It's a real indication there's recently been geese and probably going to be.
Yeah. I just wonder, so down at Goose Lake, we have phenomenal dove hunting. And I wonder if that's picked up since the agriculture's come in, the orchards, the trees, more spots for the doves, or if that was actually better back in the day, because it can be absolutely spectacular down there for doves. But I wonder how this whole shift has affected dove populations. It'd be interesting to see.
I think the biggest change that, you know, most of us have seen have been the influx of the Eurasians. And, you know, you wonder why a fish and game, you might wonder why fish and game making such a large effort to eliminate them. Well, they take over the roosting areas, the nesting areas, that they supplant where the regular mourning doves normally go and feed.
Yep, absolutely. But to think of, you know, that the antelope and the elk all in that basin down there had to be.
Now, what do you see? Rattlesnakes and roadrunners?
Yeah.
Those are the two things you see the most down there.
Yeah, I mean,
coyote every once in a while.
God, what a transformation of the landscape, you know?
Of course, you know, speaking of that, of course, market hunting originally focused on large game. And when that started to be depleted, that's when a lot of the market hunters shifted waterfowl.
Gotcha.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.